Hi, everyone. Welcome to Seeking Witchcraft. It's me, your host, Ashley, and today I have on a special guest, Tom. Tom is going to be talking a little bit about a more advanced topic, the Greek Magical Papyri, which is a collection of ancient magical texts that have influenced magical practitioners today. Tom has given presentations on this topic before, so I'm super stoked that he's on the show today to speak about this with the listeners. So, Tom, welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So, my name's Tom. I'm a classicist, so I studied classicist university and I worked on the Greek magical papyri, doing research on them. I'm also a magical practitioner. I'm a Gardnerian witch and just in my personal practice do a bit of everything. So I've worked with these texts both from a academic and a magical perspective, and I just think they're brilliant. And I'm very excited to be able to nerd out about them with you.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited for you to talk about this. So when I was kind of asking people like, hey, like, you know, if anybody has a topic they want to talk about, Tom was like, oh, I'll talk about this. And I'm like, I have no idea what that is. Perfect. So now this is my chance to learn all about the Greek magical papyri because I have no idea what this is. But when he's talked a little bit about it and how it's influenced magical practitioners today, I was like, I'm excited to hear about this topic.
Thank you. So the first place to start is, what are the Greek magical papyri? And so they are a collection of magical texts written on papyrus, hence the name papyri, that were found in Egypt. They're largely written in Greek, and the collection that we have today wasn't actually put together by the ancient Egyptians. They were actually collected by a German scholar named Karl Preisendanz in the 1920s, and have since been republished in an English edition by this guy called Betts, which is the one that most magicians work from today. So already we're not looking at a collection of texts put together by magicians. Rather, it's kind of like all these scraps of things that look vaguely magical have been put together by scholars. The papyri themselves date from the 2nd century BCE through to about the 5th century CE. So most of them from about the 4th, 5th century CE, so sort of 300-400 AD CE. And that's a span of about 700 years. And it's all the magical texts we found from that period. So at this time, Egypt had been a Roman province without a pharaoh for nearly 500 years. So it means whilst there is Egyptian magic in these texts, it's not pure Egyptian magic, in sort of square quotes. And also at this time, paganism was in decline. So this is very much kind of underground, weird, syncretic, mixed up form of magic, but it's quite brilliant as a result. We talk about who wrote. One of the first questions that's important when you look at these texts is sort of who wrote them, who was doing this magic. And the honest answer is we don't really know. We're fairly certain that some of them were priests. And the reason for this is that we call them the Greek magical papyri, but actually some of the only language on there isn't Greek. There's another language called Demotic, which was an Egyptian language. And at this period, that was only known to the priests of the temples. And this was the, sort of the last pagan temples that were open. So we know that some priests, some Egyptian temple priests, were involved in writing these papyri because this language appears on it. Some of them would have been professional magicians performing these spells for clients. We see a lot of references to clients. This was a magic that was done for other people, often for money. And one of the interesting things when reading these texts as well is some of these practitioners were obviously absolute geniuses, magical adepts who had brilliant ideas, doing really innovative, interesting things with magic. Some of them weren't. Some of them clearly had absolutely no idea what they were doing, and you get some really weird stuff coming out as a result. But I think that's great. It's great fun. And of the work of a magician today looking to use these texts is sorting through what's good and what's not. Before we come to the end of the history side of it, the other important thing to remember is not just there's Egyptian magic in there, but there's also Greek magic. So it's written in Greek. And there's also magic from other areas as well. The biggest other influence on the text is Jewish magic. So you will see the names Yahweh, Sabaoth, Adonai, Elohim, etc. appearing in these texts, these Jewish names of God. And whilst the techniques of the magic aren't Jewish, the god names and angels that you see in these spells often are. But you'll often see these god names alongside Anubis, Horus, Osiris, Zeus, Aphrodite, whoever. They all kind of get lumped in and thrown in together. So to sum that up, these texts are a collection that span over 700 years, written probably by temple priests and other magical professionals, some of whom were brilliant, some of whom were idiots. And they show a huge range of influences from a number of cultures, mostly Greek, Egyptian, and Jewish. So that's the Greek magical papyri in a nutshell.
Awesome. Definitely a lot to digest there.
Yeah, I mean that is the heavy history part. That's the bit sort of just to introduce them at the end of the way. I've got the thing that there'll be interesting, the really interesting stuff looking at these texts now for magical practitioners is how magic in these texts work. because so, and there's some things in magic in here which will, I think, surprise some people coming to magic today, and some things which seem quite familiar. And I suppose one of the first things to think about with this magic is what it was being worked for. So those of you out there who practice magic today will probably have come across spells and rituals that are less focused on practical goals and more on spiritual development. So you do, I don't know, the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram, or you do, I don't know, meditation or prayer or sort of just, but general magical practices that you do to develop yourself spiritually rather than to do anything concrete. And so that's fantastic. That really wasn't the kind of magic that was being done at this time. So most of the magic you get in the PGM is, you'll hear me refer to them as the PGM. That's the shorthand. PGM stands for Papyri Graecae Magicae. It's the Latin name for the corpus, and it just means Greek magical papyri, but it's shorter. So if you hear me say PGM, that's what I'm talking about. So anyway, in the PGM, the magic is mostly for practical purposes. And it's interesting because some of the rituals can have immense spiritual value. For example, there is a rite where you invoke the god Hermes, and that's the god of messengers and wisdom, and you invoke the god Hermes into yourself and identify your soul with him and make him one with your soul. Now, many magical practitioners today would think, that's amazing. I'm going to do that just because I want to have oneness with Hermes. That seems like an amazing thing to do. But then actually, when you look at the spell, it's to help draw income into a shop. It's a commerce spell. It's a spell to help somebody sell lots of things in their shop and get their business off the ground. And so immediately you see that even if the rituals have spiritual value, they're firmly practical. The other interesting thing is about how sort of the gods are treated. So I've talked about how they're called in for sort of perhaps menial things. They're not just treated as gods, they're often threatened. The gods are threatened. They're demons to be feared, bound, and controlled. And a lot of the spells threaten the gods with curses and terrible things happening to them if they don't do what the magician says. And this might sound weird to us today, but actually, that was mostly how Greek religion worked. Most folk Greek religion wasn't about worshipping the gods. It was about getting the gods to leave you alone, perhaps do what you wanted, or if you were a magician, getting them to do what you wanted them to do. It's interesting, I was looking at the, I'm sure many of the listeners here will be familiar with the Hex the Moon TikTok controversy, which may or may not have happened.
Oh my God, the hexing the moon. The amount of messages I've gotten about that. Guys, no.
It was hilarious, but actually someone mentioned it, and I was like, actually, that's a good point. That kind of magic does have precedent in the Greek magical papyri. So you would have, you would do things where you would threaten the gods with being chained up and sent to Tartarus, and threaten spirits with being destroyed by their gods. And there are ones where the magician threatens, I think there's one where he threatens to make the sun go down and not come back up if the gods don't do what he wants, and so on. And it's a and so that idea of actually being like threatening and cursing higher powers actually does have a ancient precedent. Now, I'm not saying I'm not recommending it, and B, I'm not saying that's what the TikTok witches were doing. But it is amusing to think that actually it's not too far off something that once would have gone on.
That's true. You know, though, I will say everyone's asking about these TikTok witches hexing the moon and hexing the fae and hexing the sun. I got to tell you guys, I think that is the absolute biggest rumor. Like, I don't think it's true, because people started saying that TikTokers were doing that. But when I went to go look for any sort of proof, and I even asked people on my social media pages, hey, show me the TikTok where this happened. I got like one dude saying that he did it, but his profile was created like a day or two after people started saying that he hexed the moon. And I'm like, well, obviously he's in it for the clout. Like, this is fake. Like, I just think it was like some people were like, let's just start a rumor, and then it just grew into this big thing, and I'm like, oh my God, guys, like, calm down, it's fine.
I think you're right. I don't think it happened, but what amused me was the accidental way in which something with ancient magical precedent actually was referenced. It was the I thought that was quite funny. So we've talked about how these sort of the gods are treated, and the magic is very practical. There is an exception, actually, to these rites in the Greek magical papyri, and these are the mystery rites. And some scholars have suggested that maybe these don't fit into the corpus because they are not concerned with practical magic, but they're there. So you've got to, and it's the, and they were clearly a part of the working notes of these magicians. And the There are three of these mystery rites in the papyri. There's the Mithras liturgy, which actually has nothing to do with the god Mithras. People get very excited and think, oh, it's a secret Mithras ritual, because we're not supposed to know anything of what they did. It's sadly not a Mithras ritual, though that would be really cool if it was. His name gets mentioned once, and one scholar decided to call it the Mithras liturgy, which is unhelpful. There's also the 8th hidden book of Moses and the 10th hidden book of Moses. And all three of these are their initiation rituals. And their purpose is to bring the initiate into communion with a deity for the purpose of their spiritual transformation. And it's interesting because these come up in the same papyri as spells for finding love and making shops work and so on. And it begs the question, why are these here? And the answer seems to be that mysteries and magic have always gone hand in hand. If you're someone who likes practical magic, you like casting spells, you like invoking gods and causing cool shit to happen, you probably are also interested in the mysteries, in the spiritual transformation that can be brought about by the interaction with deity. It's certainly what draws many people to seek out traditions, modern mystery traditions like Gardnerian Wicca. And I think that remains true. It's true today, and it was true back then, that many of these people were both magicians and initiates of the mysteries. And that kind of links into something which I meant to say at the beginning, that you see that there's sort of these diverse texts. I mentioned that these are the working notes of magicians. So if you bought the copy of the Greek Magical Papyri in translation by Hans-Dieter Betts and thought that you were going to find a collection of system of Greek magical papyri, a system of Greek magic or Egyptian magic that you can just start working with, unfortunately that's not what you'll find. They are a collection of working notes, a collection of spells. These are the kind of things that people were scribbling down in their personal workbooks, or a scribe had gone round and asked all their magical friends for their favourite spell and written it down. And the papyri has got lost over the centuries, and then they've sort of been reconstructed and put back together by these scholars. So you're not dealing with a concrete system of magic. This is not a thing where if you start here and end here, you'll get these results. It's a collection of spells and ideas and techniques, which as a modern magician, you have to sift through and find the bits that you want to work with and that you think you can use. It's not actually as scary as it sounds. It's quite doable. I'll talk a bit later about how ways in which you might want to start doing that. There's a couple of routes I want to go down. Would you like me to talk about the role of the magic in history, or would you like me to this, or would you like to, sort of in the history of Western magic, or would you like me to talk about the how the magic works in the papyri, or do you want me to talk about the gods?
I would say people would probably be most interested in how the magic works.
Okay, let's do how the magic works then.
Awesome.
So you're looking at the spells in the Greek papyri. One of the first things to realise is this is a spirit-based system of magic. And the scholar and occultist Stephen Skinner, whose brilliant book, Techniques of Greco-Egyptian Magic, I recommend to anyone who wants to look in more detail, he defines magic in the papyri as follows. Magic is the art of causing change through the agency of spiritual creatures rather than via directly observable means. Such spiritual creatures being compelled or persuaded to assist by the use of sacred words or names or talismans, etc., etc. So basically, the way these spells work is by getting spirits to do what you want. It all hinge on invoking spirits to achieve the magician's goals. Now, this is actually in contrast to a way of a lot of the magic we as modern witches do today. In the early modern period, you see natural magic developing for the likes of Agrippa and Marsilio Ficino. And in those systems, you get objects such as plants and gemstones have their own power that can be manipulated by a magician. So herbal magic, crystal magic, magic with herbs and crystals like most witches do today. And then in this sort of the 19th, 20th century, with an influence from the East, you start to see this idea that we have a innate spiritual power within us, this witch power, chi, whatever you want to call it, this power within your body that we can raise and direct to cast spells. And this energy-based natural magic is how most modern forms of witchcraft work. But this is not the way magic in the ancient papyri work. In the papyri, the objects and people don't have any power of their own. Rather, they're considered to be sacred to different entities, and you use these objects to invoke the spirit. So a magician is not someone with great power. What a magician is someone who can basically persuade, compel, con, argue, browbeat the spirits into doing what he wants. Sometimes the magician in the rituals will claim great power for himself. He will say, I will make the sun go down. I will make the sun vanish in the sky. I will raise up the dead or whatever if so-and-so spirit doesn't do this. The idea is that the magician is claiming power for himself that he may not necessarily have, because actually he needs the spirits to do the work for him. And it's all just a bit of sort of posturing. Magical, spiritual posturing, but posturing nonetheless. And thing that I think a lot of people take need to be aware of when they first come to these texts, that if you're going to work with this kind of magic, you need to be prepared to start working with spirits and to understand that they have agency in this magic and that you need to be aware of them. That's not to say that you need to be able to conjure up spirits into a triangle and do all sorts of, and like be able to sort of see spirits perfectly and be a magical adept who's able to commune with the spirit realms. If you start doing the spells, you're going to get the attention of the spirits. But it's just be aware that they are the key element within this system. The more famous, sort of more modern context systems of working with the spirits like this is sort of course, the grimoire tradition, the medieval grimoires. And any of you who have any familiarity with those will see a lot of Greek magical papyri in them, or a lot of them in the Greek magical papyri. Because the both Stephen Skinner and Drake Stratton Kent, these two occult scholars, have shown convincingly that the PGM is the ancestor of the grimoire tradition. And even systems that use energy and natural magic, we owe a debt to the grimoires. Like the grimoires had a huge influence on Wicca and other magical traditions. And so if we owe a debt to the grimoires, we in turn owe a debt to the PGM. And that's what Ashley meant at the beginning by these texts still influencing practitioners today. They are the ancestors of the grimoires, and so therefore the ancestors of us modern practitioners. And you see loads of things in the PGM that you would see later in the grimoires. So you see things like child mediums, which appear in the grimoires quite a lot. So the idea of invoking spirit into a child so they can sort of speak the spirit. This is the threatening spirits, the binding of spirits, the using of divine names to control them. I bind you in the names of Adonai, Elohim, whatever, like that kind of thing. That starts here. So it is the ancestor of much the way that we do magic today. So I suppose we've talked a little bit about the way the magic works, where this has all come from. I suppose it's probably time to look at a spell.
Ooh,
so
yes.
Why don't I read a little bit of a spell to you and talk a little bit about it? And okay. Before I go on to the spell, I just want to talk about this spell, I think, demonstrates the way, some of the strange ways in which these magicians approached the gods. And it draws mostly on Egyptian gods. And I'm going to read a bit to you, and then I'll talk a little bit about it. So this is an extract from PGM 4, so the fourth papyrus, lines 3125 to 71. Okay. Taking Etruscan wax, mould a statue 3 handbreadths high. Let it be 3-headed. Let the middle head be that of a sea falcon, right of a baboon, left of an ibis. Let it have 4 extended wings and its 2 arms stretched on its breast. In them it should hold a sceptre, and let it be wrapped as a mummy like Osiris. Let the falcon wear the crown of Horus, the baboon wear the crown of Hermanubis, and let the ibis wear the crown of Isis. So this is the instruction for creating a magical statue, okay? And it's used to help bring business into a location and to bless a space. And I really love the spell, because it is. And because what it does is it syncretizes 3 or actually more than 3 different gods. And syncretism is the process where gods are combined. So if you look at the ancient world, you often get Thoth Hermes, for example, the Egyptian and the Greek god, meshed together as one. And there's this idea that the gods are often linked to each other and two gods are combined to create a new one. That's a very common thing you see throughout the ancient world. And you see it in a particularly extreme example in this spell. So in this statue, you've got the spell, the statue has 3 heads. First one is a falcon. Now, it's fairly easy to see where a falcon comes from. This represents the god Horus. Horus was the Egyptian god of war and kingship. And this reading is confirmed by him being given the crown of Horus. Then the ibis wears the crown of Isis, which is slightly weird, as an ibis is an Egyptian bird. They have a sort of kind of similar to a stork. I'm not really a biologist. It's an Egyptian bird, long beak, and they're usually associated with the god Thoth, who was the god of writing and magic. But here, rather than being associated with Thoth, it's given the crown of Isis, who most of us will know as sort of the cosmic sort of goddess of magic. And Isis as a goddess of magic, her inclusion in this spell is unsurprising, because if you're doing magic, Isis likes to get in on that. Then finally, the baboon is crowned with the crown of Hermanubis. So Hermanubis is a very interesting god. Hermanubis, the perceptive amongst you might realise that's a mixture of the names Hermes, the Greek god of messengers, wisdom, etc., on trade, particularly in the spell, and also the god Anubis, the Egyptian god of mummification and the sort of tie to the underworld. And so both Hermes and Anubis are psychopomps. They're both spirits that guide us to the underworld and guide the spirits of the dead. And so what happened in this period was the Egyptians and the Greeks, they went, right, we've got two gods, both of whom are good at talking and working with the dead. Let's stick them both together, and we've got the perfect god for speaking to the dead. And you end up with Hermanubis. And he's quite a popular god in the PGM, and he had a small but significant following in the period when these texts were written. If you're interested in working with him, Gordon White in his book Chaos Protocols is quite a good ritual for starting doing that. So back to the spell. So the significance in that the Hermanubis crown put on a baboon-headed god, because the baboon was sacred to Thoth, who was the Egyptian god of writing magic, as I said. Thoth was equated with Hermes, so you have that you have a triple syncretization of Thoth, Hermes, Hermanubis, and it just gets. So you've got three gods. You've got Horus, you've got Hermes, you've got Anubis, all three. You've got four or five. You've got Isis, Horus, Isis, Anubis, Hermes, and Thoth. So that's five. And you've got all these five gods combined in one statue. And then the spell gets even weirder when you look at the invocation that's used in the spell. So once you've made the magical statue, you address an invocation to it. In this invocation, this is where we've already had five gods mixed into one, and then we just get a whole truckload more. So give me all favour, all success for the angel bringing good, who stands behind the goddess Tyche with you. Accordingly, give profit and success to this house. Please, Ion, ruler of hope, giver of wealth, O holy Agathos Daimon, bring to fulfilment all favours and your divine oracles. So this is it's an interesting one, because it tells us what the spell's for. So give profit and success to this house. The word house could be a temple, it could be a shop, it could be a house. It doesn't really matter. It's the idea is that any space that wants money brought into it, this is the spell for that. And then you've got all these beings mentioned. So you've got Tyche, who is the goddess of sort of fate and justice. You've got Ion, which is just the god of everything. You've got the Agathos Daimon, which is sort of personification of goodness and good luck. And you've got all of these beings being brought in together. And we've mixed with these five gods, all combined in one statue. And it's all a bit bizarre, because one of the things you'll probably see when you start practicing magic and reading up on it is that most modern practitioners tell you not to mix gods. Sensitive to the gods you're working with. Keep them, make sure they work together, have good relationships with each other. Don't just invoke gods from different pantheons in willy-nilly. These magicians evidently had not got that memo. The syncretism, the mixing, just got completely mental, and it gets particularly mental in the spell. My reading of this is a spell for prosperity, and so it almost feels like the magician is just hedging their bets and asking for help from any god that could possibly be useful. And it's up to you, really. Some people look at this and think, oh, there's something quite brilliant going on here, and I think there is some nuanced magic happening here. Also, I think maybe this is one of the less. This could be one of the less good spells in the papyri, where the practitioner didn't entirely understand the powers with which he was working. That may be a little unfair, as syncretism throughout the papyri is quite common. And I think this bears interesting sort of consequences and food for thought for modern practitioners. Because, as I said, today we tend to try to avoid mixing our gods and equating gods from different cultures with each other. It was very popular back in the day when Crowley was writing 777 and whatnot, and putting everything on the tree of life for no good reason. But a lot of people are uncomfortable with that now, and quite rightly, I think it can get bound up in issues of cultural appropriation and so on. Also, aside from that, a lot of people tend to be of the sort of the more polytheistic persuasion, the hard polytheist view that the gods are separate, distinct beings, and that it's not contrary to what Fortune said, it's not all one goddess, not all goddesses are one goddess, and not all gods are one god. Whilst I don't think the Greeks and Egyptians did believe that. I don't think they did believe all gods were one god. They certainly had a much more fluid view of the gods than perhaps some hard polytheists have today. Certainly the magicians did, anyway. If you look in the early period, when the early Ptolemaic period, so when the Greeks had sort of invaded Egypt, there's a letter from Egyptian priests of Isis. They're writing it to the pharaoh, who was Greek. So they're writing this letter in Greek, and they are priests of Isis, but they refer to Isis as Aphrodite. So clearly, even the priests of these gods viewed the names as almost sort of synonymous. And then a few hundred years later, with Apuleius's The Golden Ass or the Metamorphoses, which is a wonderful book that you can get in translation from Penguin, it's brilliant. But in this point, there's a bit where Isis appears, and she gives a long list of goddess names that she's known to by other cultures: Iam, Hecate, Demeter, Persephone, etc., which you'd see in later texts like modern texts like The Charge of the Goddess. And this idea of syncretism, of mixing gods, became really, really prominent in the Hellenistic period. So that's after Alexander the Great, because basically he invaded everywhere, up to all the way up to India, and then all sorts of Europe and Asia. And then he died, and the empire fragmented, and you ended up with lots of different kings ruling different bits. But what had happened was the Greeks, following their leaders and kings, had spread out all over the world. And they brought their gods with them, but when they brought their gods with them, they encountered local ones. And so rather than just sort of setting up separate temples, they stuck two gods in the same temple, otherwise they just stuck two gods together. And they say, well, your river god looks a lot like this version of Zeus, so we're going to have Zeus and the river god as one god. And there are thousands and thousands of examples of this if you want to dig into it. And I mean, the Romans did it too. I mean, you see it in Britain with Bath, with a famous town which was full of Roman baths, and the goddess there was known to the Celts as Sulis. Romans turned up and went, that looks like our goddess Minerva. Call her Sulis Minerva. And it happened right on the level of like just ordinary people, blogs in the street, linking the gods together, right to happening for political reasons as well. So the Ptolemies, which is the Greek pharaohs, promoted the cult of Serapis, which was an Egyptian and Greek sort of syncretic deity. And they promoted that for political reasons. So it happens for all sorts of reasons, and there are some scholars who go so far as to argue that the neatly defined gods of the classical age, so that of Zeus being Zeus, Hera being Hera, Dionysus being Dionysus, and them all being different gods, that only really existed in the whitewashed intellectual poetry and sculpture. In poems like the Metamorphoses and the Iliad, where we get a lot of ideas of the gods and myths from, see that. Actually, in the religious practice that was happening on the ground, the idea of who these gods were was a lot more fluid. So, and I think that has very interesting implications for modern pagans and witches. And I'm absolutely not telling you what to believe. You must find your own understanding of who the gods are to you, if indeed you work with gods, or find any meaning in that. I think it is worth considering, particularly if you're working with ancient magic, how ancients themselves evidently viewed them. Yeah, that's the gods. I think we've talked, I think Ashley, you'll agree, we've talked about some quite heavy stuff. So I think I might just have a little interlude by talking about one of the stranger parts of the papyri, which I think you'll all find quite funny.
Oh gosh, I'm excited.
which I call them the joke spells. And because you've got this strange situation where you've got all these papyri with these brilliant spells, and one of these fantastic papyri is the PGM-7, the seventh papyrus in the collection. And that's got some awesome spells in it. There's some really high quality magic in that papyrus. Then you get a section called Democritus's Table Gimmicks, which are a long list of practical jokes that you can do. And they're really quite bizarre and really quite funny. And I think I'll share a few of them with you now. So there's, first one is to make an, there's one of them called to make an egg become like an apple. To make an egg look like an apple. Boil the egg and smear it with a mixture of egg yolk and red wine. So you can only imagine that what you do here is you paint an egg to make it look red, tell your mate it's an apple, give it to him, watch him eat it and go, ugh, and film it and put it on TikTok. And then there's one that says, to make the chef unable to light the burner. Set a house leak plant on the stove. Logic apparently being that you can't light the stove if there's a plant pot on it, obviously. There's one that says, keep an old woman from either chattering or drinking too much. So this is one for you if you've got like an old racist grandparent that you need to make sure behaves themselves at the dinner table. Mince up some pine and put it in their mixed wine. Apparently it curbs the excessive tendencies of racist old people. Apparently. We'll see. Try it out. There's another one to make the gladiators painted on the cups fight. So obviously, if you've ever seen pictures of Greek vases, they've got all these beautiful depictions of gladiators and warriors fighting. And it says, smoke some hare's head underneath them. Hare's head being presumably some kind of drug. So basically, get high and it will look like the pictures on your cups are fighting.
Oh my God.
Then there's one for the introverts. To let those who have difficulty intermingling, so socializing, perform well. Give gum mixed with wine and honey to be smeared on the face. Smear wine, honey, and gum on your face and you will no longer be shy. Give it a go.
Interesting.
Then there's another good one. And of course, it's humans, so of course in the end it gets a bit blue. Be able to copulate a lot. Grind up 50 tiny pine cones, tiny mind you, don't want anyone to think you're compensating, with 2 ounces of sweet wine, 2 pepper grains, and drink it. Apparently that will increase one's virility. Now,
is that even safe to ingest pine cones like that?
I have no idea. Don't sue me if it's not good. Don't try it. I'm not condoning you trying this. I'm just sharing what the ancients would have done. And the final one is to get an erection whenever you want. Find a pepper with some honey and coat your, and the translator quite sweetly here has written, thing, inverted commas. Find up a pepper with some honey and coat your thing. Now, I hope I don't have to tell you that you really don't want to put pepper on your penis.
that's the quote of the entire show right there.
And I think you can just imagine that someone's come up with this and their mates come up to them and say, oi mate, right, know you're a wizard, right? So look, I've been having a bit of problem in the bedroom, the missus isn't very happy, I just need some help, you know? And he says, don't worry mate, I've got you covered. Look at this this is an ancient spell that I found in some ancient text, try this. Of course his mate does it. Gets a very sore willy, and then everyone laughs at him.
I can only imagine. I would not want a honey and pepper coated quote unquote thing to be inside of me.
No.
On the opposite end of that. So.
Yeah, I think it's just a bad idea all the way around. And I think what I love about this bit of the papyri is so many people go to these papyri going, right, this is a tome of ancient magic they romanticize it. They put these texts up onto a pedestal of being these fonts of amazing wisdom. And in some respects they are. In some respect there is some absolutely brilliant magic in these texts. But it also just shows that these people were human beings. They were not sort of strange up there high adepts. They were ordinary people like you and me who enjoyed a good joke. And that's a slightly cruel one in this case. And I mean the most total sense, if you look at like the likes of Aleister Crowley and whatnot, and who has got up to all sorts of no good, it's the magicians have always had a bit of a dickhead streak, and I think that's no less clear, no more apparent even than in this bit here. And I think that's a general piece of advice if you're looking at these texts, is discerning and appreciate that these are not always the fonts of wisdom, these are working notes of a magician with some brilliant bits, some silly bits, and some stupid bits, and you've got to work through that yourself. But yeah, those are the joke balls, and I love them to pieces.
I remember it was like this Tumblr post going around, and I don't think it's from the papyri, but it was some like ancient spell book that was in a museum or something, and it was a rain spell. And apparently, back in the ancient times, for the rain spell, you walked outside with a bucket full of water, and then you dumped it on the ground, and then you essentially looked up at the sky and just started yelling at it, saying, see, this isn't so difficult. Why can't you do this?
I've seen that one. I think it's brilliant. It's exactly the kind of thing they would do. That's exactly
the thing. You know what? Sometimes the best magic is just the most simple.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, you challenge the elements, and sometimes they'll challenge you back.
Completely. They will. They really will. So I suppose the question that may be going to be on many people's minds is how we use these texts. If we're magical practitioners today, probably some people look at these texts and they're quite overwhelmed with the sort of the amount of maybe history they might think they need to know, or the fact that it's translated from Greek and so on, and or the fact that it's not a ready-to-use system handed to you on a plate like you get in some books. But actually, if you're willing to have a bit of a, if you're willing to be to challenge yourself and have a bit of a dig and try some interesting things, then actually you can really get somewhere with these texts. And first of all, I want to talk about some of the issues you might encounter once you get over your initial phobia of, oh my god, this looks scary, and give it a go. There are a few issues that usually come up, and like, here are some of my, in my opinion, solutions. So the first one is difficult ingredients. So there's one that involves having a severed wolf's head. Don't know about you, I don't have one of those lying around. You might do, I don't know. I don't. And so what do we do when we come with these difficult ingredients? So, well, some purists will tell you that you must replicate the spells as closely as possible. They'll say if you're not willing to go and get all the difficult ingredients, then you're not a proper magician. Someone tried to tell me that on the Facebook group, and I probably told them to sod off. It's really not true. It is true that, like in cooking, making substitutions may alter the flavour of the magic slightly, but magic is fluid, it's not chemistry. You can absolutely make substitutions. But what's important is that you understand why you're making that substitution. It's not just out of sort of laziness. I'm making this decision to change this ingredient for this because for whatever reason I can't obtain that ingredient, but I think this ingredient will have a similar impact on the spell that I'm doing and be similarly pleasing to the spirit. And there are a number of ways you can check that. I mean, you can go down the scholarly route of researching, sort of food prohibitions in ancient Egypt, which I once did for a day. All you can do is just use your understanding of magic. And if you're not sure, check in with the spirits. Get out a pendulum, get out your tarot, or wherever else you like to talk to spiritual powers, and ask them, saying, will you accept this instead? And see what they say. It's always worth just asking. And there are plenty of spells that actually use ingredients that are readily available from most good occult supply shops. The other issue, which sort of the wolf's head thing links into, is animal sacrifice. So animal sacrifice is a tricky one because I am not opposed to it in principle. I eat meat. I strongly believe that most of us in this culture do not know how to do it properly. There are traditions that do. There are many wonderful magical traditions that do have people who are trained in how to do this humanely and properly. So many African diaspora religions, for example, most of us practicing modern witchcraft do not have that skill set. And so I think it fairly rules out that animal sacrifice, because you can do perfectly effective magic and do plenty of spells from the papyri without it. And I think if you're just doing it to be edgy and for the aesthetic, that's not a good reason to kill anything. And also many magical practitioners just are opposed to killing animals full stop. They're vegan or vegetarian or whatever, and that's also completely valid. So be aware that you will encounter several spells that do basically condone animal cruelty. So there's this one spell that involves drowning a falcon in milk, for example.
Oh my god.
Yeah, well, that's because the reason for that is drowning was in the River Nile was believed to deify a person undergoing it, and the falcon becomes a receptacle for a divine spirit which you invoke. There's a theological magical reasoning for it, but nonetheless, drowning animals, bad form, really. So something to be aware of, that you will encounter this, but to the enterprising magician, there is certainly workarounds. The other one is language. So there was a widespread belief that spells should be said in the language they were originally written in, or they would lose their power. It's a widespread belief in the ancient world. Personally, I've used these spells with great success, and I mostly say them in English, because whilst I can read ancient Greek, my pronunciation's a bit dodgy. So it's easier to do it in English. And you certainly don't need to be able to read ancient Greek to use these texts. The only bit where it becomes... language becomes important is with something called the Voces Magicae, actually magical voices, magic words. And these are most of the spells are made up of. And they are nonsense words. They are words that have no meaning, they're untranslatable, and they are chaos magicians today theorize that they're to help you put in an altered state of consciousness or whatever. Maybe they do that. That's not what the ancients would have said. Would believe to be secret names of spirit, the names of gods and spirits and powers, and listening out these secret names gives you power over those entities. So sometimes these names will be written out, will be spoken out loud. Sometimes they will be written down. So here, for example, is an invocation to the goddess the waning moon, and the words go like this: Forba, Forba, Forboleo, Forba, 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 Borfor, Forba.
That sounds like a huge tongue twister.
Exactly, it's a bit of a tongue twister. So I would, if you're going to do one of these spells, I would suggest you practice your pronunciation before you do the spell. And those I would say always keep. If you're doing a spell and you absolutely use the English translations given by Betts, you might want to pretty them up because they're not very pretty translations. Then keeping the Voces Magicae, because to the ancients, that's where the power was really considered to be. And I think there is something I can tell you from experience, there is something very powerful about standing in a room full of incense, chanting these names. The Chaos Magicians are right. It certainly gets you to a magical mindset, and the spirits like it too. So these issues, these sort of problems and issues you might encounter, but all of these are surmountable. And so when you've got these texts, you can use them as a source of techniques, for techniques and inspiration. So say you want to do a Hecate spell or something, you can go and you can look at the spells involving Hecate in here, which are loads. If you love Hecate, you must read the Greek Magical Papyri, because there is so much on her in here. And I will read you a little extract from one of those spells in a minute. But you can use the way I certainly work with them is I go, right, what do I want to do? Okay, how do they do it in the papyri? What can I take from this? What can I use? What am I not going to use? So, for example, I was recently working on a ritual to ensoul my god statues. So statue ensoulment was a common practice in the ancient world, particularly linked to Neoplatonism and theurgy, which is a sort of magical philosophical school, and where you invoked a god into a statue and made it their home so that you could then engage with the deity through the medium of the statue. It was a central magical practice, and I was like, right, I want to do this with my gods. So the gods I was working with were not Greco-Egyptian gods, but I thought, well, I'm going to mine the tech, so to speak. So I looked in books on theurgy, which the tradition does this often. I looked at various statue ensoulment rites. They all said they claimed inspiration from the Greek magical papyri. I hadn't thought at first of the papyri, and I went, of course, look at them. That makes so much sense. So I went back to them, and I went and said, well, where do these rituals actually come from? And there are several rituals for creating magical statues in the PGM. We looked at one of them earlier, one for whether you combined all the gods into one to attract money into a shop. They're all for specific purposes, like bringing prosperity. They're all using specific gods, and they all make use of animal sacrifice. So I was like, well, I know which gods I want to do. It's not these ones. I know what my purposes are, and they aren't the same purposes, and I'm not going to do animal sacrifice. So how can I adapt this? So I went through and I read all the statue spells and identified the key techniques that kept cropping up. And these were writing names of power on papyri and putting it on under the statue. That's right, I can do that one. I don't have to use papyrus because they only used papyrus because that was the paper they had. I could just easily use any other paper. So use paper. Making sacrifices to the statue. Luckily, my deity does not demand autumn sacrifice, so I was thought of other traditional offerings I can make instead. Then there are petitions written on the statue. I already had my statue, I wasn't making it from scratch, so I said, right, well, that's fine. I'll write mine on paper with words of power that I can maybe wrap around the statue or put beneath it. And then finally, the statue is made from materials linked to the deity. So if you, for example, the spell we read earlier talked about Etruscan wax, that was a particularly good quality kind of wax, and other spells involve various herbal and animal bits that you stick in to mix in with the clay or the wax that you're using to basically make the statue align with the deity. So what I did was I already had a statue, I created an oil from material sacred to the deity and anointed the statues with it. And that actually has precedent in one of the spells in the papyri, because that is something that happens in one of the spells. Then there's an interesting thing that crops up in a couple where the sacrifice, so the bird, so usually a bird, and this is coming back to the animal cruelty thing, unfortunately, the bird is strangled in order to give their breath to the statue. And obviously I was like, I wasn't going to start strangling any pigeons. So what I decided to do was I turned instead to that concept of giving breath and the Jewish tradition and the Kabbalistic tradition of the breath of life, which is in keeping because Jewish magic has such an influence on the papyri. Perhaps better to say the papyri had such an influence on Jewish magic. So I used that of using my own breath of life to breathe into the statue and enliven it. Whilst I won't talk much, as much as I'm mostly unwilling to talk about my own magical, that particular magical working, I can say it worked very, very well. The statue didn't get up and walk around. I had an incredibly intense encounter with the divinity with whom I was working. So I would recommend statue ensoulment. If you're interested, give it a go. It's a brilliant practice.
Awesome.
another spell that, for those of you, I mentioned Hecate earlier, and there's a brilliant spell in the papyri that actually is that if you're interested in doing it, I would totally recommend. I mean, I'll give you the reference right now. You'll be able to find it online. And it's PGM 4 2785 to 2890. And it's the prayer to Selene for any spell, Selene being the goddess of the moon. And the spell actually is largely an invocation to Hecate, because Hecate and Selene are syncretized and basically treated as the same being. And those of you out there who enjoy working with Hecate, of Hecate, as many modern witches are, then if you haven't tried this spell, then you absolutely must. It is a long invocation to Hecate that draws upon all her different aspects, both her beautiful and her terrifying, and syncretizes it with a number of different things. So it goes, "Come to me, O beloved mistress, three-faced Selene, kindly hear my sacred chants. Night's ornament, young, bright, bring light to mortals. O child of the morn who rides upon fierce bulls. O queen who drives your car on equal course with Helios," that's the sun, "who with the triple forms," performed Hecate, "of triple graces, dancing revels with the stars. You are Justice, and the Moira," that's the fate's threads, "Clotho and Lachesis and Atropos. You are three-headed, your Persephone, Megaera, Electo. You have many formed. You arm your hands with dreaded murky lamps. You shake your locks of fearful serpents on your brow. You sound the roar of balls out from your mouth. Your womb is decked with the scales of creeping things, with poisonous rows of serpents down the back, bound down your back with horrifying chains." You've got that really horrifying bit. Then you've got this bit, lovely, "night crier, bull-faced, loving solitude, bull-headed." And you get these, and then she's called the horn, "mother of gods and men and nature, mother of all things. You are the beginning and the end, you alone rule all." So she gets treated as she gets called, treated like a fierce evil demon, or described as such. She's synchronized with the fates, with the furies. But she's also described as the beautiful moon, as the mother of all creation, the supreme goddess, as nature herself. And that might seem paradoxical, I suppose it is. But when I first encountered these texts, that confused me. I thought, well, how do I really want to call on the negative aspect of the goddess? I think what they understood better than perhaps I did, and many do, that the gods are paradoxical. They are not two D archetypes you can fit into a box. They defy all definition and categorization. So if you are to call upon Hecate and truly access her power, you must appreciate both the terrifying and the beautiful within her. And what's lovely is the spell is in effect all it is. It gives you this long invocation, a protective charm to wear, because in this magic you always wear a protective charm. Because gods and spirits were perceived as dangerous. You always wear a protective charm when you are doing this kind of magic, which again is something you don't usually see in modern witchcraft today, but I think we often tend to believe that gods and spirits have our best intentions at heart, and if we have good intention is everything, it will be fine. This is a system of magic where intention really is not everything. The gods and spirits couldn't give less of a damn about your intention. You need to, they will, if you screw it up, they'll fuck you up. That's just kind of what they do. At least that's certainly the belief behind these texts. So if you are working with this, some form of protection is definitely recommended. And some rituals give specific ones. There is also in here, I can't remember the reference, a general protective talisman that you can make as well for these rites. So gives one of these, and it also gives an incense for the spell for doing good. Which is storax, myrrh, sage, frankincense, and a fruit pit, which is all stuff you can get from any metaphysical shop. I think I've got all of those in my herb box. So you can... This spell is brilliant. If you want, it gives you an incense, it gives you an invocation, a protective talisman, which you can then adapt and use in your emotional and magical work with Hecate.
Have a quick question. So if somebody wanted to use that, for example, like get that information, how can they access this?
So the Greek Magical Papyri in translation is a book. You can get copies of it online, but the best way is to get the physical copy from any good magical bookshop, or indeed Amazon or Book Depository, anywhere really. It's easy to get hold of. It's called The Greek Magical Papyri in Translation by Hans Dieter Betts, or edited by Hans Dieter Betts. And if you're interested in the original Greek, edited by a German man named Karl Preisendanz, is available online. You can find that online, long out of copyright now. And I would highly recommend getting a copy. The other book that I would recommend, that if you're, because the Betts copy is not particularly user friendly, because there's a long contents page, but it's just lists all the spells in order, and if you're trying to figure out what to find for what, it's a bit of a lucky dip. So the other book that I would highly recommend is The Techniques of Greco-Egyptian Magic by Stephen Skinner. He gives the history and theory of this magic, and then he breaks down he lists all the different spells by kind of theme and the techniques used in them and the powers called upon and so on. And it's been it was an invaluable text to me. It's most useful for me. I personally use it most to help navigate the text so I can help find things quickly in a pinch. I don't always agree with his historical viewpoints, though largely I do. So, but it's a brilliant book. So that would be those two books, The Greek Magical Papyri in Translation and Techniques of Greco-Egyptian Magic, I would say, looking to do these spells, those are the texts to go to. I would also say the brilliant blog as well that I came across the other day, by this guy called Sam Block, who gives various workings taken from the PGM. And most usefully, he gives an opening and closing ritual. So if you want a ritual to kind of frame around your spell, you can find those online as well. So there's all sorts of stuff out there for the enterprising magician. It just takes a bit of research and a willingness to do a deep dive. I'd highly encourage you to do it. I did a deep dive on these a few years ago. I've never stopped, really. It's great. I'd highly recommend it. But yeah, I suppose that's kind of... I know we're coming to an hour now. So I'll just sort of sum up by emphasising that these are... So the Greek Magical Papyri are this collection of texts written in Greek and Demotic, with combining Greek, ancient Greek and Egyptian and Jewish magic. Some of it's brilliant, some of it's silly, some of it's stupid, and you've got to pick, but it's not a complete system. You have to pick it out and work with it and research it. The magic is spirit-based, so you have to be prepared to work with spirits. The gods are often syncretized and mixed together. You have to be prepared to take steps of magical safety by wearing a protective talisman, because the belief is not that the gods have your best at heart, but that you need to protect yourself from them and approach this carefully. But the magic is actually very accessible, and there's all sorts of things in here that any modern magician can do. And if you love a bit of ancient magic and you fancy a challenge, I would absolutely recommend getting involved with it.
Awesome. You know, I really appreciate you coming on to talk about this topic, because I've joked about this before, how, you know, a lot of people think that when they're getting involved in witchcraft, like, it's very just, I'm trying to figure out the best way to phrase this, but it's very easy and just natural and go with the flow. But when you want to kind of go a little deeper with it, witchcraft can be extraordinarily academic. There's a lot of reading involved, a lot of studying, a lot of research, and it doesn't necessarily come off like that when you're first getting involved. But then hearing about topics like this and, you know, how this is influencing magic today, I don't know. I just really appreciate having these more advanced topics so people kind of get a taste of, like, it's not just, you know, this one little book or like this one YouTube video. There's a lot more that's involved in this if you want to go down that rabbit hole.
Oh yeah, it's a rabbit hole of many lifetimes, and I frequently get overwhelmed by, I'm like, oh, I want to study this and I want to do that and that. How can I do all of this at the same time? I need more lifetimes. But I mean, hopefully many magicians believe in reincarnation, so if they're right, I have got many lifetimes, but find out when we get there.
yeah, just the trick is trying to remember what you knew in the previous lifetime and then going from there to try to apply that to this lifetime.
Yes, indeed. And that therein lies a challenge.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Tom, for giving like such an academic talk. I really appreciate this. And I think, you know, as I mentioned, it is definitely an advanced topic, but I think it's so great to have something like that on this show. And I'm going to ask you a question I ask everybody at the end. So it could be about what you just talked about, or it could be about anything you'd like. But so if you were talking to a complete beginner, you know, maybe they haven't cast a circle yet or even attempted to spell anything, if you can give them one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say, and it might sound contrary to what the sort of the talk I've just given, is don't get overwhelmed by the amount of material out there. Easier said than done. Magic, the only way to learn magic is to do it. Even if you do your first thing, you go, right, I'm going to just try and cast a circle, and you feel like a lemon standing there, standing around in your room, pointing your finger at the floor, envisaging blue fire coming out, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's the moment of starting. And I think, yes, there are complex systems of magic that have rules and risks and so on, like the PGM. But if we're to learn from the example of the PGM, whilst they are... there are complex elements and perhaps dangerous elements of it, it's also, these people were incredibly creative. One of the things when I was studying these spells in depth that I found was how creative the approach of these magicians were. They would take all these different ideas and combine them into one, and totally new spins on complex philosophical ideas. And so that creativity should start now. So just get on practicing magic. It's simple. whatever it is, first simple thing that seems appealing to you and get creative with it, because that's the only way you're ever going to learn. And who knows, you might go on to create something amazing.
Exactly. And, you know, that is definitely a theme. Whenever I ask people, like, you know, their piece of advice, almost everybody says something that relates back to just get up and do something.
Yeah. I think it is the number one piece of advice.
Yeah. I mean, you can read about magic all you want, but until you actually get up and you practice it, nothing's going to happen. You're not going to improve just simply by reading something. It's like if you're training for a marathon and you read all these tips and tricks online about how to run faster and how to do this and how to do that. Unless you actually like get outside and start running or whatever training you're going to do, you're not going to run faster just by reading these books or reading these things online. So it's the same with magic. You have to practice it. You have to see what works. You have to get engaged and get involved. And it's extraordinarily important to do
exactly.
This.
I mean, so in the case of the PGM, you can easy one to start with, like the Hecate spell, and just do it. Just see what happens. Go for it. And the
there you go.
Yeah. And hopefully some cool shit will happen.
And if not, don't get discouraged.
Absolutely. I mean, I've done. So sometimes magic does do cool shit. A lot of the time, it's like, oh, that was nice. It's just give it a go and see what happens.
Yeah, you know, I read this interesting, it was like a meme type thing where it was something like, if the gods come every single time that you call them, do you think they're actually coming? And I was like, ooh, that's interesting. I like reading that.
That is interesting. I mean, personally, I think they always do. I just don't think they always come with earthquake, wind, and fire. I think sometimes they are, it's mm-hmm. just a sense of a hand on the shoulder or a presence in the room. It is a... I mean, certainly with spirit magic and god magic, I think the advice is if you've done the invocation, so act as if they are there, even if you're not sure. Because if you have called them and they've showed up and you just haven't picked up on it, then you're going to look a bit lemon if you go, oh, that didn't work, I'm going to go have a shower now. The god's going to be there like,
then the god's just sitting in your room like, excuse me, you need to dismiss me. What are you doing?
So I think always if you're going to do it, if you're going to do something like this, and even if you don't think anything's happening, follow the process through anyway. It's the... And as Alistair Cody said, invoke often, do it lots, and things will eventually happen.
Yeah, and you know, I think that is a good point. Even if you're not sure if something's there, treat whatever spirit or god or energy or elemental, whatever it is that you're trying to call down, treat it with utmost respect, regardless if you think that they're there or not, because maybe you just can't sense it yet, but you also don't want to piss them off by thinking they're not there.
Yeah.
When they very well might be there.
I think on the pissing off note, we mentioned earlier about how there is the threatening and banishing and so on of gods in these texts. I wouldn't say for beginners. I would say if you're working in a PGM system and you know what you're doing, fine. But don't just think that's a license to go around ordering the gods about, because they are a lot bigger than you.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just one other way to kind of phrase this. It's kind of like, even if you think that they're not there, you don't sense them. There are so many stories or examples I can give, but like, think of it like if you go to a place that's haunted and your friend sees a ghost, but you don't see a ghost, or vice versa, you see the ghost and they don't see it. It's kind of the same concept. Just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not there.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Tom, so much for coming on. Please tell me how people can find you if they have questions, because I'm sure that they will.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Tom MacArthur. I'm on Twitter as Tom MacArthur. At the moment, that is the only magical online presence that I have, in public one anyway. I'm hoping to start a blog soon with a friend, which we may call Cross Country Witchcraft, but that has not been put online yet. Who knows, by the time it comes out, it may have done, but we'll see. But certainly, if you want to find me in anything else that I'm doing magically, you'll find me as Tom MacArthur on Twitter.
Cool. And so with that blog, so we're recording this episode, but I told Tom we're recording it on this day, but it's probably not going to be published for a little bit later. So if anything changes and you do get that blog post up between now and then, I will update the episode description, and then just whenever you get it posted anyway, I will come back and update it, even if this is already published, because I can apparently do that, which is
awesome.
Cool.
That's amazing. Thank you. That reminds me of the other thing that will be up by the time this podcast goes up, is that I'm doing a talk for the Center of Pagan Studies on the Greek Magical Papyri, which will cover a lot of the stuff we talked about today, but in a lot more depth, and I'll be reading through some spells with the people and looking at the particular spirits from within the text and so on. And that is going to be, I believe, that we put on YouTube. So you'll be able to, with the Center for Pagan Studies, so you'll be able to find that YouTube.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'll add a link to that as well to the episode description if it's out during the same time. And if not, whenever it comes out, I'll edit. Yep. Cool. Well, thank you so much again, Tom, for coming on and sharing all this amazing knowledge. I, again, is so happy to have just a more advanced topic. It's really refreshing. And I think that the listeners will be appreciative of that too, because, you know, beginner witchcraft 101 can sometimes get repetitive, at least, you know, when you've been doing it for a bit. But having just like a topic that's a little bit out of the abnormal realm or something you might not hear just from anybody,
yeah.
just like the normal pagans online, I think this is cool. I'm really stoked about it. And I hope that everybody listening likes this topic too.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, no problem. And to everybody listening, I just want to give a shout out to my Patreon. So the Witchlings, Neophytes, Seekers, and Dedicant. I just recently got a Dedicant Seeker on Patreon. Holy shit, guys. That's insane. Thank you to that person. I'm really stoked. I also want to say, if you want to find me on Facebook, you can find me at Seeking Witchcraft Podcast. It's just like a Facebook like page. I also have a Facebook community group called Witches Seeking Witchcraft. Please like the question or answer the questions, guys, if you're trying to join that. And then you can find me on Twitter at Seek Witchcraft or on Instagram at Seeking Witchcraft or on Patreon as Seeking Witchcraft. Surprise. Everything's just Seeking Witchcraft except Instagram or Twitter, but that's fine. All right. Well, I will talk to you all soon. Thank you again, Tom, for coming on, and we'll chat later. All right. Bye, guys.